Monster Man, special episode, Cozy Monsters. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Edwin. If you'd like to be like Edwin and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, as well as the monthly behind-the-scenes episodes where I talk about, well, anything and everything. So Edwin, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's show. Edwin has asked me to talk about monsters, or monster encounters, where the resolution is not violent. And he links to a blog post, which I will put a link to down in the show notes, about playing a game called Underhill by Water, which is about playing little folk, similar to, but legally distinct from, hobbits, but not the ones that go on globetrotting adventures, the ones that stay home and deal with, like, primarily seed cake-related problems. He describes the game as being focused on awkward ants and ornery goats. Now, it has often been observed that role-playing games tend not to have the same distribution of genres that you find in other media. Now, this has changed a little bit over the last 20 years, largely because the success of shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or whatever made serial genre action adventure shows much more popular in, like, mainstream television, and then of course, like, superhero movies and the Lord of the Rings films and so forth. So there's more of that kind of, like, heroic genre cinema, but for a long time it used to be kind of noticeable that most shows on TV were, like, doctor shows, cop shows, or lawyer shows, but those genres are not very represented in role-playing games, which is also changing a little bit too, but never mind. I mention this because these types of conflicts are another example of something that is very common in other media, but quite uncommon in role-playing games. Much human drama doesn't revolve around adventure. It's to do with other forms of social interaction. And that can be a serious look at the way in which that social interaction illuminates both the personalities of the characters and the norms of the society at that time, like the Age of Innocence, or it can be a lighthearted view of the foibles of that society, like Carry On, Jeeves, or it can be somewhere between the two, like Sense and Sensibility. Although those are all very different stories, or in the case of Carry On, Jeeves, collections of stories, the conflicts are motivated by similar stakes: love and friendship, personal goals, sometimes weird goals, and the tension between social convention and the desire to live as the authentic self. Characters fear things like disapproval, or judgment, or a stern talking to from an angry aunt, rather than, you know, getting shot with an arrow. But if we're to take these types of stories as the basis for our game, then what role can monsters play in this? If we're thinking about Tolkien, to whose hobbits these halflings are similar, although they are legally distinct, the world of monsters and adventure is beyond the Shire, right? It's either far away or it's in the past. And when it does interact with the Shire, the consequences can be tragic, heroic, but also tragic. We could not have a dragon in this setting, or at least not a dragon as it is typically understood in fantasy gaming, right? Because dragons care about big things, about the eternal things. They care about conquest. They care about riches. The aesthetics are all wrong. They don't get involved in the petty squabbles of good folk in the village. They destroy the village and let the good folk worry about themselves. You could maybe have a little dragon like Idris the dragon in Ivor the Engine, but that's very different from a dragon as we understand it. So if we are looking for monsters that can fit into these types of stories, then I think we're looking for creatures that can provide conflict within that kind of village setting. We are in a world of slap-up teas and pints of ale on warm spring evenings and gooseberry cake competitions at the village fete. That doesn't necessarily mean this kind of like bucolic Little England thing, but I think what that represents is a sort of lowering of the stakes. This idea that these are creatures who take these types of things extremely seriously. And so the stakes are high about who wins the gooseberry pie competition at the village fete, not because that is actually a large thing, but because it is funny that these people in the village treat it as though it were a large thing. And that means that high stakes can be attached to anything that disrupts that thing, even if it's not exactly a threat to life, limb, or property. Small chaos that disrupts the orderly way of life and the carefully balanced plans of these basically good-natured but somewhat fussy and competitive villagers. We're looking for monsters that do mischief. And here's the thing, there's plenty of it around. In fact, in my view, both folklorically and literarily, I would say there are probably as many monsters interested in mischief as there are monsters that are interested in conflict. There are so many that when these creatures are included in fantasy games tend to demischiefify them. So we have seen lots and lots of mischief-making creatures who have been reimagined in a way that makes them more violent and dangerous because of the assumption that what fantasy games deal in is violence and danger. So I have picked what I think are four broad categories of monsters that fit in well to this type of story, and I'm going to think about some ways that we can incorporate them and maybe the types of encounters that they have in common. Let's take a look. Category one in my notes is just marked You Know Who, because this is a type of monster that I've been talking about on this show for a long time, and one of the things that I've been talking about is how uneasily these creatures fit into a heroic quest narrative, or a dark horror narrative. These are types of monsters that have been fitting uneasily into fantasy adventure games for nearly 50 years. They're obsessed with pranks, they pilfer, they like to inflict comic pratfalls. We've seen examples of these creatures doing things like kidnapping characters and then shaving off all their hair, or creeping up on characters in a dungeon and tying their shoelaces together, or snipping the straps of their backpacks, lowering the tone and making you regret playing the game since the 1970s, and now their time has come. Now is the time of shenanigans, now is the time of red-faced, low-stakes aggravation. Cometh the hour, cometh the little stinker. That's right, the little stinker monster finally has a place to not completely wind me up, because the sort of self-importance of the village folk, right, the way in which the not-hobbits, the nobbits, let's call them, take their petty village rivalries and their schemes to grow the greatest marrow in the village super seriously is both comical and endearing. And little stinkers can target that exaggerated sense of self-importance. I'm talking about brownies, imps, leprechauns, pixies, sprites, bookas, germlings, kilmuluses, mites, umplebees, atomies, boggarts, boggles, pecans, grigs, corids, pecks, quicklings, and so on and so on. Those ones that I named are just the little stinker monsters from the first three seasons of the show, and I've probably missed some of them. Folklorically, the kobold is kind of just a little stinker, come to that. And a goblin is kind of just a little stinker. This idea that they're razor-toothed hamstring cutters is the product of fantasy games not sure how to fit little stinkers into a hostile world. But they don't have to be distorted to face this game format. They work in their original folktale context. So these are creatures who take as much pleasure in disrupting the orderly life of the cozy Nobbit village as the Nobbits themselves do in experiencing it. I remember when I was in high school, I was once waiting, I think, for a ride or a bus or something, and there was a sign, not like a stop sign or anything like that, but like it said, you know, it said where the visitor parking lot was or something like that. And it was stuck in the ground outside my school. And it was pretty late, so most people had gone home. It was after the end of the school day. And two of my friends who were also waiting with me, I think they were waiting for something different, but they were hanging out there as well. And they had realized that the sign was kind of loose, and they were starting to work it back and forth, hoping that they could pull it out of the ground. A car rolled up, and I think it was a physics teacher. I can visualize him quite clearly, but I can't remember his name or what he did. And he said something to the effect of, "You could probably pull that thing right out of the ground, but would it be the right thing to do?" And we were all just kind of nonplussed. And after he left, everybody just started laughing because it was such a sententious, high-minded thing to say about something that was ultimately so trivial. Now, from a distant, more adult perspective, it's not trivial, right? If we had, or they had, I had nothing to do with it, if they had pulled that sign out of the ground, it would have been work and expense for somebody to put it back in. It would have been a nuisance. It would have been a nuisance, and some people might have had their trips to the visitor's parking lot delayed, which would have been annoying. And these days, I think you probably shouldn't inflict annoyance on other people for no reason. But when you're in high school, everything can seem, if you're lucky, if you're a lucky child like I was, everything that happens in high school can seem kind of consequence-free. Nothing you do does anyone any good, so how could it do anybody any harm, I guess? You live in a sort of imaginary world. Anyway, I think that's what little stinkers are mostly like. They're not sadists, they just kind of don't think you're real, or maybe that anything is real. They got that kind of Roger Rabbit aspect to them. Okay, so that's category one. Little stinkers. One of the nice things about these little stinkers is that they often come with their own kind of rules. You know, the Fossergrim, he's not particularly a stinker, he's more of a landscape monster, but he has all these rules about, like, giving him a gift of silver, and then he'll teach you to play the fiddle. So they can have both positive and negative aspects, depending on whether you observe the rules that go with them. Monster type number two, talking animals. Right, the cozy fantasy world dwells in the landscape of, like, the small town, the, you know, the farming village. Sidebar, I'm very interested in the way that fantasy games represent the Middle Ages. And what's interesting is that I don't know that that many of the sources that fantasy games are based on are all that explicitly medieval, like Paul Anderson, maybe. But not even all of those. So for instance, quite a lot of the Shire, in terms of its attitudes, in terms of how society is organized, in terms of the terms that people use for things, and even in terms of images that are not like tied to any specific technology, but that are in terms of the time that they evoke for us, like drinking tea or smoking pipes, those are kind of from the modern period. And if you imagine a TV show that is set in, like, a village in that period, the establishing shot will always be sheep being herded through the street, or, like, a bunch of geese out front of somebody's house, or something like that. There's always, like, that one shot where there's, you know, a horse cart going past, and then a bunch of geese, and then a kid playing with a hoop. And you got to imagine that each of these stout little knobbits, looking like a kind of ambulatory Toby jug, has his own little bulldog that follows him around. And I think animals are particularly important to the world of this kind of cozy fantasy because the cornerstone of the relationship between people and animals is food. Animals understand the centrality of food in a way that I think also halflings do, if that makes sense. So for instance, so this provides lots of opportunities for animal mischief, right? So clever cats sneaking cream, or like a dog running off with a string of sausages, pigs on the loose getting into things like digging up the vegetable garden, or animals that get in the way of your treats, mean guard dogs outside somebody's apple orchard, that kind of thing. Now, there is, in real life, a potential for violence there, but I think that within this kind of pastoral fantasy, nothing is going to happen to you that is worse than something that would happen to Ur-Wooly in this kind of setting. If that guard dog catches you, what it's going to do is bite the seat out of your trousers as you climb over the orchard wall. But animal monsters, animals that can talk, animals that are smart, animals seemingly possessed of a malevolent will, are a good type of monster for this sort of bucolic environment. And typically, I don't think you would get very many wild animals. These are all going to be animal monsters rooted in the domestic landscape. Although birds, you might get birds. We've discussed whether like an eagle is big enough to pick up a halfling in the past. Okay, next up, we've got blundering monsters. Now, this could be any very large monster, but for these purposes, I feel like a giant is, and one of your smaller giants, like a hill giant kind of size, is where you want this to be. Drunk giants sleeping with your haystack as a pillow, or like a clumsy giant accidentally putting his foot through a thatched roof, or a giant that decides to take a bath, and then like the stream overflows, and the meadow is all covered in water. Giants are almost like natural disasters, but sort of, again, for the purposes of this type of game, they're more inconvenient and embarrassing natural disasters. Like, nobody wants to get stepped on, and certainly nobody wants the giant to put its mighty foot down on top of, like, their cucumber frames. And these work really well because the monster is so big that it is something that these little characters could not possibly overpower. A knobbit's not going to overpower much, as a general rule, But if it's at all possible, there's always that slight temptation to try, which is contrary to the aesthetic of this type of story. So you want the characters to want to deal with the monster using planning and trickery and misdirection and so on, finesse. And that's the only way you can deal with a giant, because there's no way you can muscle it. So you need to have your friend dress up like a ham and lure it away or whatever. And this is that particular type of fairy tailed giant that is like a big clumsy bumbler, right? It's not malcontent. It's not going to attack the PCs, but if it decides that it wants to drink up the big cask of ale that you're having delivered for your granddad's birthday party, then you're not going to have any ale in time, and that's going to be a disaster, and it just might. The fourth type of monster that I think can be included in this type of game is like the monster of the landscape. I mean, let's pause for a moment and kind of try to clear our minds of the Little England cultural trappings that go with halflings. A bucolic small town setting. We got a series of challenges, but those challenges don't have violent resolutions. And we've got some kind of supernatural landscape and a focus on food and minor comforts. I got two words for you. Hayao Miyazaki, right? I mean, am I not just describing? Well, okay, I mean, like, not all of his films, and not Porco Rosso or, like, the early adventure films like Castle in the Sky, but certainly kind of like mid-period Miyazaki, before later films that are quite serious, after the adventure films of the early period, like My Neighbor Totoro, or even Spirited Away, or, for that matter, okay, it's in a different kind of setting, but there's some of this in Kiki's Delivery Service, or Ponyo. So, okay, Ponyo's maybe not that inscrutable, but like Totoro is a great example of just putting this weird supernatural creature in a normalish landscape. So you're in this kind of like, again, small town community, everybody knows everybody else, like you're looked after by granny, the eternal rhythms of country life, etc., etc. And then there's the forest king, who's maybe a troll or something. But I think the point here of this kind of weird monster is there's sort of a spectrum, right? And at one end, we have the really weird monsters like Totoro. Totoro is just this odd guy who thinks that the umbrella that he's given is a musical instrument because he loves the sound that the rain makes when it hits it, but he doesn't understand why he wouldn't want to be rained on. My point is really that My Neighbor Totoro is not really about Totoro, right? For all that he's this beloved icon, he's really not in all that much of the film. It's about how the kids react to Totoro. And the highest level of drama that you might find in this cozy type of game is kind of what you get in Totoro, right? The search for a missing child because everybody's concerned that she might, you know, fall in the lake or whatever, or go like where there's too much traffic. But she turns out to be okay, it's fine. And then you even get a little like heartwarming moment out of it. Similarly, the payoff to like the sense of dread that hangs over My Neighbor Totoro is, yeah, it's fine. It turns out fine in the end. It's not about Totoro or Totoro's weird spirit landscape. It's about how the kids react to that and how it makes them feel. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, we have more like interactable creatures. And I think a lot of the Spirited Away monsters fall into this category, where again, the protagonist, whose name I don't remember, has to sort of solve their problems for them, deal with them on an individual level, but certainly doesn't overcome them. And indeed, in many cases, what's happening is that she's realizing that they have some problem that they need her help to solve, so that they're not just monsters, but they've got something that they need to deal with. You also get this kind of like animate elemental forces, like, for example, the fire guy in Howl's Moving Castle, again, whose name I don't remember. You know, so you might have just like some river monster that kind of embodies the river and gets PO'd because the, you know, the bucket in the well is itchy or something like that, right? Now, if you're Miyazaki, or for that matter, Isao Takahata, you tend to include a lot of sort of environmental messages with these kinds of characters, and you can do that, but you don't have to. It's just that, you know, this is a theme that concerns both filmmakers, but I think there are lots of things that these characters can do that would upset these creatures without necessarily having to be so direct about it. I can't believe this. For some reason, this made me think of Messing About in Boats, which in turn made me think of Three Men in a Boat, which in turn made me think of the swan thing. I can't believe I didn't have mean swans as the kind of encounter that might, you know, something might be in the way of some halflings, right? Like you decided that you wanted to take your neighbor for like a romantic boat trip, but there's like a mean swan between you and your boat. Okay, so speaking of conflicts, what are the kinds of conflicts that we can include these four types of monster in. Obviously, with your Totoro types, you've got like just charm and color, right? Totoro doesn't particularly connect to a certain conflict. He's just a fun little mystery for the kids to explore, but it's the act of exploring the mystery that's important, not any resolution to that mystery. We don't particularly wind up the film knowing any more about Totoro than we do at the start. It's just that we like him. So, you know, a thing you can like without having to understand it. You can have madcap action, right? Like a certain amount of slapstick, I think, is pretty fitting for this type of game. And that's the, like, chasing the dog when it steals the sausages, or, you know, being chased around the water meadows by a swan when all you wanted to do was have a little boat picnic. You can do the, like, tests of ingenuity, so, you know, trying to lure the giant away from the village so that it doesn't put its foot through anybody else's roof or decide to drink the horse trough or what have you. Or you can have socially awkward situations. I do like the idea that monsters can come in a more conventionally monstrous mode and then be dragged into awkward social situations. If you remember the entry on the Bacan, there's this idea that Bacans are associated with a particular family. And I think it's the Bacan where there's a story about how, like, the Bacan hangs around challenging the sort of head of the household to fist fights. And I love the idea that Bacan might show up to your house, like with its sleeves rolled up and its mustache bristling, looking to challenge you to a fist fight, only to run into your somewhat dotty aunt who invites it to tea. And then you have to sit there, you know, sipping tea and eating seed cake across from the Bacan as it meaningfully cracks its knuckles. So these are my thoughts on categories of cozy monster and types of conflicts that they could be involved in. Now, obviously, these are not exhaustive, but these are the ones that came to me today on quite a nice spring Sunday morning as I was sitting with a cup of coffee, hanging out with my dog, and filling it out. I just thought I would mention that to help reinforce the cozy domestic ambiance. So, Edwin, thank you very much for your continued support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Edwin and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're getting pretty close to the end, we are going to be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you'll join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.